The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
Good evening. You're listening to Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight, we present part two of our epic interview with the controversial Beelzebub on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Cinema, with the focus is on film that matters, cult, grindhouse, driving, independent, and underground film from the dawn of the talkies through the early 90s. Tonight, we present part two of our interview with Beelzebub, radio show host, magazine entrepreneur, and independent SOB filmmaker. This week, we're playing a little hardball, so be prepared to take on some tough topics and frank discussion in the conclusion of this conversation with the controversial filmmaker. While clearly a man of deep thought who inserts monologues and steers discussions towards eschatological issues in any possible juncture, Bill's also a true iconoclast who steers his creative endeavors with a strong eye towards offending any and all comers in the comedic light. So be warned, if you have hot buttons, prepare to have them pushed tonight. Join us as we speak to Beelzebub and the conclusion of our interview right here on Third Eye Cinema.
Well, a lot of people say you can use my music if you want to, and the motivation for that is these people know that the movies get out there and get seen, and they know that people who watch the movies may hate the movie, but they may like the music. I know the motivation is, this is my way to get famous, give bills above my... From all the years of the magazine, I might have told you this before, I've cultivated friendships with bands and with record labels.
Right.
And so I'm very lucky that way. You know, I've paid my dues to these people, and I'm not saying that I expect to use music, but I have special arrangements with bands and labels, and the latest band has been Primordial, which you love, from the Pagan Metal documentary. So I got permission to use some tracks from their Spirit, The Earth, The Flame album, which I think is amazing. That's
it
a perfect album. Okay. And also a Hungarian band, Die Katafalque, and don't tell me to spell it. You'll hear it soon. So that album is entirely in Hungarian. So in Night of the Pumpkin, I gave the message via a character's dialogue that people who say they don't like death metal because they don't understand it, people who say they don't like death metal because they don't understand the lyrics, I wonder how they would justify liking opera then if they hear music in another language that they don't understand. I like a lot of opera. I don't understand the words. Maybe I read the translations later, but I like the emotion in the voice. So the voice becomes an instrument to me, so to speak.
Right. No, I'm the same way.
So, I mean, there are other reasons for hating death metal. You either resonate with it or you don't. You know, you have to like it on a visceral level. Like, I have to go to shows to show that I'm not this fat nerd in a basement hiding from everybody and just making all these remarks, you know, not ever facing the music. I have to go out there, you know, when people challenge me, well, now I know that it's unwise to do that just for liability, but I used to be like Bruce Lee. I'd have to go to every show where people said I'd get jumped. You know, even the Milwaukee Metal Fest in 1997, that was the high point of the death threats against me.
Wow.
Venom was playing at Milwaukee Metal Fest, and I didn't know what that event was like. This is before the Marshmallow Meltdown and all that stuff.
Right.
So I decided, you know, I'll go. Oh, that was also a turning point for the magazine because the Milwaukee Metal Fest chose me to do the program. All right. So that propelled the Grimoire to the highest print run ever because it was the Grimoire plus that. And the program really was just two pages of the program and maybe some ads from some new labels, and maybe some interviews that I would not normally have done, but they were playing the show. But there was this band, I think it was called Living Sacrifice, and when I heard that they were Christian, instead of putting Living Sacrifice in their spot, like, you know, 6 o'clock on stage 2, I put Gay Christians. But anyway, I've learned just from, you know, pre-everything that it's not the people who make the threats that are that much of a concern. It's the people who won't say anything.
Right.
You know, if the person says, like, fight outside at 3 o'clock, he's got something on his side. You know, like, if you were to be attacked at a show, the person attacking you probably just wants to show that he's brave. Because
right.
at a show, a fight will get broken up within 2 minutes, you know, depending on the security. Or how much you're hated, but it'll get broken up within 2 minutes. So if the guy is losing, you know, he could make some sort of story like, oh, yeah, you know, he did this. But, you know, the fact is I did attack him. And if
right.
he's winning, you know, it's just broken up before any kind of negative story can be told. You know, you've got your honor points or whatever. You've
right.
attacked that guy. So I had been jumped before because at MSC, I don't even know if you know this story.
No.
I had a girl read her boyfriend's love letters on my radio show. And he and 10 to 12 other people didn't find that too funny. So I got jumped at a show. And that's how I know that it'll be broken up within 2 minutes. And if that had happened outside in an alley, then I would probably be altered right now. I would probably not look the way I do today.
Right.
But...
But it's
kind of funny because it doesn't hurt at the time. So knowing that, you know, I got beaten down by 12 people and, you know, walked away from it. I couldn't walk right away, but
right.
you know, I was okay. I decided, all right, I'm not going to really be frisked. I can bring in whatever I want, my camera bag. And I wasn't thinking about bringing in weapons. I wanted
right.
to get jumped.
Right.
So I thought Milwaukee Metal Fest, there will be all this press there. I will really put the Grimoire on the map. Because back then
right.
I wasn't really making movies. I was just making skits. So I looked far and wide, and I found spinach that had a pull-off cap.
Okay.
And I just wanted, at the moment where I got jumped, to take the spinach out of my bag, pull
right.
off the top, and eat it like Popeye, and just flex my biceps while I'm getting pounded, you know, like, and dancing around like the sailor dance. You know, that would have been the best story, but... Nobody jumped me, and the people who I met who were shaking, they were all half my size, so these are the tough guys on the internet. I'm not saying that everybody who has threatened me has been small, because that really is not true. But since those days, I have never found spinach with a pull-off cap. You can find it in corn and other things. It was just a synchronicity moment for me.
In terms
I'm
of
sorry.
The...
I don't have any idea what the question was.
I know, we got way off topic.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, Bill Zubub. Coming up, we discuss Unoffending Everyone, Rap Sucks, and Self-Recrimination. Only here on Third Eye Cinema. Offend any and all comers with everything from, you know, dick and fart jokes to you're inserting scenes and dialogues that can come off as racist, homophobic, blasphemously anti-Christian, misogynist, and so forth. You really love to push people's buttons. Are you really that bristly, given that I don't get that impression that you're right-wing in orientation? Anybody who's seen your films know that you're very anti-police, anti-military, anti-establishment, for example. But the fact that you seem to actively appear to be out to offend everyone possible makes it hard to take any of it seriously. Is that the point, or you're really just out to piss everyone off?
Well, I don't want to really say too much about that, because I like for people to interpret as they will, you know, and if you believe in the unconscious, maybe there's something that you can read into me. I don't know. There are some points I'd like to make, though. I am very suspicious of people who react. I'm suspicious of white people who don't use the N-word. Of course, there are people who use the N-word, and they're sort of like the Klan type of people. So in that case, the way they use it is a pretty derogatory way. But I I don't like knee-jerk reaction things. To me, I equate thought police and this shortcut knee-jerk reaction, like if you hear the N-word, you know, you get hot and bothered, but you don't know why. You just do it because that's the flavor of these times. You know, that's the expected reaction. So I like to point out in the movies when that kind of material exists that yelling at someone for using the N-word doesn't make you moral. It's understanding, you know, why this word or that kind of sentiment is bad. You know, just...
Because, you know, there's a lot of historical...
I just have to be very careful about the way I answer this because it's very important for people to know that I really don't like... conformists are necessary, but I think that they're dangerous because the people who are very vocal about the N-word and stuff like that in the 40s could have been people who were killing, you know, or committing atrocities because that was the thing that you were expected to do. So conformity is a bad thing, I think. It's a good thing in that, you know, people can march into gunfire to protect you, but it's a bad thing. Also, calling somebody a racist is the same thing as calling somebody an N-word. In the movies, I say that when you call somebody a racist, you dehumanize that person. Whatever that person says is automatically stupid. Why is it okay to call somebody a redneck with the same kind of hatred that rednecks use against,
but
know?
Yet that's the whole point, and that's why people get upset when people use certain code words, whatever they may be, whether it's, you know, racist or misogynist or homophobic or whatever, because there's historical weight behind these things being used and intended. You know, it's not like they're friendly names, like, oh, here's my friend over here, he happens to be gay. It's like, oh, yeah, it's this fag or whatever. And there's people behind this for years that were using this to put them down, to box them, and to actually abuse and hurt these people. You know, make them, like you said, make them devalue them as their humanity, basically, by dropping them into some sort of little, I don't know what you want to call it, like a box, basically, and saying, okay, well, this is not, they're not as good as us. You know, they're not worthy of being human beings. They're more like animals because they're X, Y, or Z. And that makes these things, even though, you know, you might not be intending them that way, and you're looking for, I think you're trying to just bust everybody's nuts and make it so that basically people that stay with you have to sit back and say, you know, it's just Bill. You know, he's just screwing around with you and trying to say, why are you getting offended at anything? What the hell? You know, we're all the same. But that's just my take on it because a lot of people are really going to get upset, and I'm going to address that shortly, because these words do have that code meaning. It's like when you bring up the Nazis – on the one hand, people will recognize them as a historical thing, and they'll think, oh, God, these people were terrible, whatever else. But there's also this code thing underneath this conversation where, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's associated with this and what they did and people that supported this and still support this to this day that make it, you know, I hate political correctness, but, you know, it's got that kind of a thing where it's like, wow, maybe we should really dance around this subject as opposed to, you know, jumping right in and tackling it head on, much less using it in a glib fashion. So that makes it, you know, that makes what you're doing a lot of times really questionable. And I'll get to that in a couple minutes here.
I don't want to contradict you because I like for people to interpret things, and it shows that I actually made you think.
Right.
You know? And that's okay if you think I'm an asshole. I'm fine with that. But also, my area of research, how should I say? I don't think that the things I read or the things that I study are things that are exciting to a lot of people. And also, a lot of things that I read are theoretical, so theory doesn't mean truth. So I also found that a lot of things that I've read have been challenged by new science. And the mark of science is whenever there's evidence for something, you know, you discard your previously held notions. So I'm talking about neuroscience versus psychoanalysis. That's a troubling thing for me. So I have a hard time letting go. I'm battling it right now, actually, in a university. But if you are a person who likes neuroscience, you'll know that we are very good at categorizing things. We put things into categories. Right. And, you know, sometimes the categories are race or, you know, people dress a certain way, like different cliques dress a certain way. So I like learning about the way the brain works in that way. But I also like Jung and Freud. They sort of had a hydraulic sort of way of looking at the mind where it's energy. And I really hope I don't sound like a madman. I'm telling you, and I hope I'm not losing your listeners. It's just that I know a lot, and it's very hard to put that into a couple of sentences. But when people are told they can't say a certain word, it doesn't mean that that word disappears from the person's mind.
No, that's
stronger. And
that's more weight.
I think we were talking about when I went to Texas, and most of the people had extremely good manners. It was like going to Andy Griffith's show.
Right.
It's like being in Mayberry. And at first, I thought it was really nice, but when I was talking to people who had to move out of Texas, they said, you'd never know who your enemies are.
Right.
Everyone's smiling, and so...
That's actually my experience of the South. That's why I can't stand it down there, because I've been down there a couple times, and it's creepy, because somebody's there being very polite and nice to you, and got a big old smile, and yet you look in their eyes, or you turn your back, and you hear them talking about you, and you know that they can't stand you. Especially being a Yankee, because they still carry that crap. So,
well,
so I find it very frightening to be down there.
Right. Well, I'm going to Charlotte in a few weeks, so we'll see if I survive. Anyway, what I'm trying to say is, you know, I have a lot of heavy concept. And I try to play around with them in the movies, and I'm not afraid to rile somebody. Comedy is supposed to be a social mirror, or in some ways a comedy is a social mirror, and my comedy is a social circus mirror. So I really go through extremes. You know, some movies have gone out of print because I got out of them what I need to get, and I guess they're going to appear on torrent sites. But there's a reason why they go out of print. I don't really want them to be seen anymore. I've gotten the data that I needed. But it's up to you to judge. You know, am I a racist prick? Am I right wing? The singer of Gwar, who is in Jesus the Total Douchebag,
right,
playing Satan, when he first read my magazine, Dave Brocky, who plays Odorous Urungus in Gwar, first read the magazine, and he wanted to meet me to yell at me. Then he understood what was happening. And so
Okay. We've
had many laughs about, you know, we're sort of liberal, and I'm not saying liberal in the political sense, but we're sort of liberal-minded people who use right-wing humor. But I also use left-wing humor, you know. But an interesting thing that I've noticed is that there are people who laugh at my brutal humor until the finger points at them, and all of a sudden I'm an asshole. I guess the bottom line is, you know, think of me what you will, but it's not going to stop me from approaching certain subjects. I'm not afraid of ugly topics.
Personally, I find it hard to take your stuff with a straight face. To me, it's pure absurdism and theater along the lines of a modern-day Louis Buñuel. So I appreciate what you're doing for the most part, and I definitely get some good laughs out of it. Who do you think your core audience is for the films?
I don't know. When I started selling VHS copies of skits, was that? No, when I started having nudity in the magazine. If you wanted to get my magazine through the mail, I requested a photocopy of a driver's license.
Okay.
Just to show age. Because I really don't want anyone under 18 to either read my magazine or to see my movies. I'm not interested in entertaining kids. I want to entertain people after their personalities have formed. Well, maybe not formed, but in your teens you go through phases, maybe. I was always an asshole. But you should go out into the world and learn things on your own and not have me teach you anything. You know, I'm there as your junk food, not as your steak dinner. When I asked for people to send me license pictures, I found out that most of my readers were not metal-looking people, and most of my subscribers didn't like metal.
Really?
People just loved the brutal humor of the interviews. You know, especially, you had asked me why I discarded the old English. I didn't completely discard it, but bands started getting to know who I was. Something like that is great when I'm an unknown. But, you know, there are people, you know, starting the question like, how art thou? To me, you know, so like, no, don't use my weapon against me. So I tackled other things. But with the movies, I started realizing that I don't have a particular crowd, especially when I go to horror conventions. You know, there are people who teach film who think that I'm an embarrassment. And then there are people who teach film who talk about me to their students. There are people who are teachers of other subjects who tell their students to watch my movies. And there are also people who despised me, couldn't stand my movies, and they became converts. I have to use that word because that's the only way to describe it. They hated it.
Right.
And now they love it. But there's no one type. There are people who hate metal. They're very punk rock, maybe, and they watch the movies. But I guess it's the same thing as me watching a mainstream movie that has rap music in it. You know, I'm tortured while that's going on. But if I find the movie funny, you know, that's the price to pay.
So speaking of that, and speaking of offending people, tell us about Rap Sucks. I like your write-up you posted in IMDb, so let me quote this for the listeners. Rap sucks, yet has become mainstream, which made the world into a hell for people who haven't been brainwashed into liking the stupid trend. Laugh or wince as you watch the characters in this movie struggle in a world where they no longer belong. I find that I feel the same way, not just with the prevalence and ubiquitousness of the white rapper crowd, so to speak, but with any number of cultural trends and everything from car styles and reality TV, also commonly known as the Walmart crowd, to film, music, and quote-unquote entertainment over the last few decades. I really don't understand the pervasiveness of the cultural shift. People seem to have no concept that they've evolved. The changes are both embarrassing and apparent, but when confronted with this, people just get blank stares like they have no idea anything's wrong here. And yet, you always take things to an extreme, like with the jive-talking drug dealer character, and I think it was the remake of Dirtbags. I mean, that's so over the top, it can't not offend, or just leave the viewer into shrugging their shoulders in disbelief, like, he can't be doing this in this day and age. How do you justify such deliberate assaults on people? And forget about if we're talking about religious people. You know, worst horror movie, for example, really rides not only Christians, but Muslims as well.
Well, Rap Sucks has, how should we say, in regard to rap, in metal circles and even in intellectual circles, there's sort of a wonder, you know, what kind of times are we living in?
Right.
And I remember my visceral reaction to rap becoming mainstream was, you know, of course, because there's no artist development, you know, there's really very little musicianship. I'm admitting that this is my visceral reaction. It baffled me, and I was thinking, you know, you can make things look like they're cool. There are many experiments that are done in the world of psychology about conformity and about you second-guessing yourself. You know, you as a growing person, you might have thought, rap really sucks, but am I just stupid? Is there something wrong with me that I don't see something great in it? Because everyone else seems to. So there are these experiments.
That's just metacognition. That's part of being smart and being intelligent, is that you question your own motives and your own feelings.
Well, the experiments that I reference, they have people perform tests, whether they're mathematical or whatever, and the correct answer is very obvious, but the other subjects in the study, they're plant, you know,
right.
they're not real subjects, but they answer incorrectly, and the majority of them answer incorrectly. This is where the actual test subject sees the other participants, you know, what their guesses are as the correct answer. So I saw a lot of that based on my experience in the whole rap phenomenon. It really bothered me because the lyrics in the songs that I love are poems. You know, they're not like, hey, baby, that's Motley Crue. Fuck that kind of metal. But I was wondering, why is the music that I love, which is intellectually superior, condemned? And, you know, rap songs, I don't know. Is there any intellectual rap? I'm sorry about the long build-up to this, but as I was thinking about these things, I realized, and I try to make other metalheads realize, that death metal was never mainstream, it was never accepted, and that there were always other fads that were irritating to us.
Right.
You're as old as I am, or just say you're
close,
older.
Close
so... In the early days of underground metal, there was glam that was very irritating to us, you know, and then there was grunge. The whole grunge thing took over, and then, you know, metal was never at the apex. Metal was always underneath everything.
Right.
And it's just like if you go to a mall, even if there were no musical criteria, you would not be a friend to everybody. You would only be a friend of very few people who go there, you know. So we would always be outsiders.
Right.
So rap didn't usurp us. When glam was around, you know, we were the unwashed and unclean. You know, there were maybe some, you know, if we're equating success or mainstream with, you know, like all the girls want to sleep with a guy who looks like a girl rather than, you know, a guy who looks like a barbarian. Anyway, with Rap Sucks, I really wanted to address that because I thought that a lot of people needed to be reminded that metal was never number one, that we were never displaced. We were always on the outskirts.
Right.
And then I wanted to show that the real thing was to look at, well, I don't want to say, you'll have to watch the movie, but Rap Sucks in the beginning will rile you, but hopefully if you stay with it, you'll see the real message of it.
And right.
I don't know. Am I talking out of my ass?
No, because I'm going to get to that in a minute. But what really amazes me is that you would think from viewing some of these scenes, not just in that film, but in other ones, some of these scenes, images, and dialogues, that this stuff is coming from an intensely angry person, and yet you don't seem that way, really. You know, you've always come off fairly easygoing, sarcastically funny with an absurdist bent, reasonably intellectual in a very free-thinking sort of way, a modern satirist with some of the bite of a Twain, a Wilde, or a Molière, but couching some rather crass, lowbrow trappings with all the comedy. So where is all this bile, might not be the right word, but where is this coming from?
I think it's important to exaggerate things to make the ideas easier to understand.
Right.
And also, there's maybe a dreamlike quality, because in dreams, emotion is amplified. That's interesting that you made that point and you asked that question. I don't know where that comes from. I don't think that I'm a maniac inside.
No, I don't get that impression at all.
But I'm more full of doubt than I am of confidence. You know, when people rant in the movie, they're usually characters who have extreme confidence. And I also like to show that confidence does not equate to intelligence.
Right.
You know? Who knows where that's coming from, but it's not something that I consciously feel. I like just to exaggerate things. And when the blackface character appears, he's just as over the top as possible. So you that's not a real character. That's not a real person.
But I have to talk specifically to Rap Sucks for a minute here. In my own experience, I found, and you know, you won't like this part, that in the very early days of the medium, back in the 80s and maybe the very early 90s, but not quite that far, it was actually sort of amusing. You know, it was just a bunch of guys rhyming and bragging about themselves. You couldn't possibly take it seriously. It was just fun. And I actually used to enjoy it, and I still listen to some of that early stuff on occasion. That said, sometime in the early 90s, we found ourselves with this whole ridiculous gangster thing foisted upon us, and particularly with a few high-profile deaths during that decade, people suddenly started to take all this seriously as if, you know, this is what it's really like to be part of African-American culture. And it's actually incredibly racist and insulting, because what they're presenting as truth is a celebration of poverty, crime, drugs, and murders. I mean, how would you like it if that was what was presented to the world as what being, you know, Czech or Romanian or Norwegian or French or Italian was all about? And astonishingly, you get an entire generation or generations who buy into this picture as if it were reality, and they do their best to live down to the stereotype. It's patently absurd. So I agree with you on that much. And you did make a few good points in there, like how the media controls the masses, as I was just inferring above, but also the devolution of language, particularly that whole I heart thing, which really pisses me off, but also the apparent need to reduce everything to some corporate design but presented as colloquial abbreviation or acronym. I mean, this sort of thing is just obnoxious, and it effectively dumbs down an entire culture over time. And also that whole bit about how mainstream cultures adopted rap lingo as if it were proper English, which is just mind-boggling and embarrassing. I also really like most of your conversations with your Swedish girlfriend, Ida Bergman, later in the film. My wife even made a comment how it's scary of how much of what you were saying at that point, you know, when you're out in the snow talking with her, was actually true. But all that duly noted, you really push things way over the top in this particular film, especially in the first half, as you mentioned, during those D&D sessions. I mean, despite the fact that this was a fairly typical Beelzebub comedy in most respects, and you know I enjoy your comedies, there's really no other way to describe Rap Sucks, but it's incredibly racist. I mean, it displays all the progressive spirit of the Deep South in circa 1955 in those scenes anyway. I had to pull my jaw over the floor for the better part of that. I mean, I know these are your words and scripts, but I was watching this in disbelief, wondering, where did you find that British girl at the National Front? I appreciate your iconoclasm and the fact that you take the time to think about major sociological concerns, but, you know, especially in that first half, it's really hard to defend it. It's like all the questionable bits that might have been sprinkled throughout your other films were just kind of collated into one and expounded on in depth. I mean, you had several gorgeous girls in this one, especially Ida Bergman, your Swedish girlfriend, in the second half, which is more typically a Beelzebub half of the film. And I loved hearing her talk as well. That was a lovely accent. But, for example, I couldn't believe the scene where you effectively kicked the Brazilian girl out of bed out of fears of miscegenation. Because it was just so, I don't know, like you guys mentioned yourself, the first half was just like, oh my God, what am I watching? And then the second half, all of a sudden it goes back to being one of your films. I'm like, oh, okay, this is what I'm used to. It's safer territory.
The movie got a huge number of submissions, and a lot of actresses wanted to play the racist characters.
Wow.
You know, and in the Dungeons & Dragons game, the thing that was supposed to happen, and like I said before, I can fail in an experiment. The thing that was supposed to happen was I was supposed to show that left wing and right wing are both the same thing. In the games, there was always an ultra-racist character and an ultra-non-racist character,
an anti-racist
character. And so their banter was just to show you, you know...
They're both are idiots.
Shut up. Shut up. Both of you, just shut up. And that was only supposed to be one character for the racist side and one character for the anti-racist side, but I ended up dividing those. So right. There are two extra characters, but it was supposed to be the same, same characters. I don't know if that was a good or bad idea. You're sort of saying that maybe that was a terrible idea, but I tried it. You know, it's not one of the popular movies. I'm a little dismayed about that. I was trying to figure out why. Like, is it because of the cover? The cover is just so nice. It's like a Disney.
You know, you get the pretty face there. It's so sweet, and then you go inside, and you're like, what am I watching? And then, you know, finally get past all that to the second half. And it's like, okay, this is a typical, I'm used to this. This is, I'm comfortable with most of this stuff. But the first half is like.
but beyond everything, it was an experiment in that, you know, the first hour is almost entirely dialogue driven.
Yes, that's true.
There's really nothing other than dialogue. So I was having fun with that idea. But my character was supposed to be a person who just was a product of his friend. You know, he may have had ideas that contradicted what everybody around him was thinking. You know, everybody around him being racist. When he met the Melissa character, she was supposed to be a person who wasn't an anti-racist. She was a realist. But there was not a bad thing about her. She was an innocent. The battle for my character was, you know, do I buy into the propaganda or the thinking of my circle of friends, or do I give up my friends and go the route that my new girlfriend is taking me? You know, this is a character who has been pretty much selfish his entire life. Which way will he go? Are we always essentially the same person? Can we actually change? So those are some of the questions. I don't really want to make it look like the movie is any more sophisticated than how you feel it is or isn't, you know, but there was a lot of thought behind it, and I don't know if I succeeded or failed. It's still a little early. I do remember a lot of people walked out on the movie when I first screened it.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you had more of what was going on in the second half earlier on, it might have translated better what you seem to be trying to get at here. But that first half was just, you can't not picture people walking out of the theater. I mean, I would actually picture people coming down to punch you in the mouth or something, because some of that stuff was really like, what am I watching?
Well, on subsequent viewings, I did warn the crowd what was going to happen, and I asked them to stay, and there were still people who walked out, so
right. It
really ruffled a lot of feathers.
Yes.
So next time I will not invite any birds to the screenings.
One more question. Actually, it wasn't what I had planned on, but what was with that very experimental ending? Because it seemed like she had dumped you, and then all of a sudden you had, I guess it was like an acid trip, and it looked like you had died, and then there was that whole thing with Odorous and, you know, her spirit arguing over where your soul was going to go, and it just got really strange. So where was that coming from? It seemed like a real departure out into left field somewhere from the rest of the film.
You'll have to just interpret that as you will.
And you also mentioned it was edited down from like a 3-hour movie.
3.5. I may revisit that idea in the future, but I don't know. I do think that there's a lot of entertainment value, at least in the script, and I forgot to call attention to something in there. The similarity. All right, Margaret Mead was a person who made a very bogus study about a people on an island,
right. And
without going into the details of it, because you can look it up on your own, but it showed that humans are way more similar than they are dissimilar. You know, we have a lot more similarities. So I was trying to find examples of that, even with metal and rap, and you were talking about how rap had this gangster sort of thing, and I noticed in malls that was a lot of the bravado, the posturing, the tough talk, but that happened in the stupid metalheads too, you know, that they were the black metal people that, you know, really were that. So that was a similarity, you know, white and black. Black metal and rap had that false tough guy thing, like, you know, just because you were involved in the scene, you know, you were gun-toting or sword-toting, whatever, or church-burning, whatever. So I may revisit it sort of like as a Rap Sucks light in the future movie, but I just still have to collect a lot more data, if you will.
And yet and still, with all the areas we discussed, it's impossible not to note the consistent strain of self-recrimination where you really put yourself down in your dialogue in most or all of your films. Is this a device to soften criticism by taking yourself down first, a la Eminem? Does it seem like it takes away from any potential offense from other parties to show that you don't take yourself very seriously either?
Yes, that's exactly it. The more brutal the insults are toward other people in the movie, the more brutal the insults there are toward me, to show that I can take a joke. And the insults in the dialogue, Well, I don't want to say they're all true, but you can laugh. Like, I make fun of, well, I don't make, the characters in the movie make fun of my forehead, my
right.
teeth. Sometimes my weight is a little less than sexy. So these are real insults. You know, people could see how brutal they are. So if I can laugh about that, I will not admit that my pee-pee is small. But I think you'd agree that that's probably the most humiliating thing you could ever say about a male.
Yes.
So that's common. Hopefully that's the message, that if that can be said about me in my own movie, then you can relax if the insults kind of hit close to home.
Yeah, and I got to say that is what I picked up. It's like, well, you know, this guy can't be taking this too seriously because, you know, he's taking a piss out of himself as well. You listen to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Beelzebub. Coming up, we discuss Night of the Pumpkin and some weird fetishes in this film. Only here on Third Eye Cinema. Serious than your usual films, or at least the ones that I'm familiar with. It was a bit outside your usual comfort zone, and I don't think it really worked. There seemed to be very little actual plot or narrative movement. It was more like one long conversation. What my partner Matt on that level would refer to as mumblecore. And what bugged me is that not only wasn't there any real comedy this time around, but there weren't any real philosophical issues being discussed. And the worst sin of all is that the characters seem to be making enormous leaps in logic with not too much information to support them. It really felt like a sort of lazy screenwriting, where it's clear that the author just kind of dropped these wild conclusions in their mouths to cover holes in the narrative. And even what was there, what the viewers actually sees to support these ideas, was pretty far-fetched. I mean, the supposed Christian character who keeps talking about her Queensryche necklace as if it were a cross, busting in on the goth witch's house to smash her head in with a hammer, that just happens to be laying on the kitchen floor, mind you. I'm no fan of judgmental conservative types by any means, but isn't that a bit of a stretch for someone who practices that religion? And, you know, just in general, I don't think this one really worked. Even the extra where you try to explain what you're shooting for seemed to be really, like, way out there. So, I mean, you're practically talking about UFOs.
Well, in your viewing experience, the movie failed on every level. but it was a movie that actually worked very hard on. The script is much more serious than the actual movie, and it's one of the scripts I have laid aside for the day when I have a real budget. You know, there are a couple of different, like Zombie Crisis, another movie that has a much more serious script than what could be filmed with the money I had at the time. But Night of the Pumpkin really began with a couple of ideas. One is attributing human emotions to things like animals and plants.
Right.
And I guess you can be fooled that animals have some expressions that are similar to ours. And even if, let's say, your guess about their state of mind is close, they just have a different way of thinking about things. They don't have language. They don't have the giant forebrain that we have.
Right.
So the way they think about things is different, and the way you think about my movie is a little different than an actual intelligent person. No, just kidding.
You want your honesty? I'm just trying to.
No, I like your honesty because I have noticed some directors get very defensive if someone doesn't understand. I don't want to say that you don't understand. If someone just doesn't like the movie, all of a sudden the viewer is stupid. And I'm not like that. I always.
You're actually right. I didn't get what you were trying to get at here. I still don't. So that's what I'm saying. Look, this is your forum here. Tell me what you were trying to go for here. And, you know, maybe we can make sense for the audience.
Well, my intentions were to sort of give that or show that. What am I trying to say? See, no wonder the movie sucks. But. So there's this vengeful pumpkin creature. It's sort of like a soldier ant. He is not vengeful the way a human is vengeful. He just attacks things that have been marked with certain spores. Like when the pumpkin creatures from a long time ago, when they were attacked, they released spores onto spores might be the wrong word for it, but they emitted this substance onto the attackers for the soldier pumpkin creatures to attack and eliminate because they're dangerous to the population. And then they also have friendship spores. The reason why I talk about that is the end of the movie, the pumpkin seems to have forgiven a character, but the real thing that happened was that she wasn't marked. And the other thing is the pumpkin creature just has a mask. So any kind of expression or any kind of feeling is your own imagination.
Right.
But the heart of the movie was I wanted to show a female lead that conquers as a woman using feminine virtue, feminine qualities.
Okay.
Because I've seen female characters in movies who are depicted as strong, but they're strong as males. They fight, they swear, and women have a lot of superior... They almost have an Eastern way about them, an Eastern way of thinking, where they can allow themselves to appear weak, and then they spring. Whereas males, whenever they attack, they like to show facade.
Right.
You know, like, this is how strong I am, or whatever.
Right.
But without getting too much into that, because we don't have all day to discuss my greatness, those were the primary motivations. I also wanted to make fun of the whole end of the world thing, the Mayan calendar, because if the Mayans really had the gift of prophecy, why didn't they predict their own downfall?
Right.
You know, as far as I'm concerned, they perished way before 2012. I don't care. I just wanted to make fun of that whole end of the world hysteria. Because, you know, I have basic ideas, and then I wrap the movies up into other things. And the Christian versus the atheist, I was afraid that people were thinking that I'm a flag-waving atheist. Because I think that once an atheist belongs to a group of atheists, then that person's an idiot. Because I'm not into group mentality at all. The atheist in Night of the Pumpkin is one such person that I wanted to give equal insult to the atheists. Where, you know, both those people, I just want to show both of them are stupid, just as in Rap Sucks, the right-wing versus the left-wing people are so caught up in arguing about things that they hate about life instead of just living life.
But beyond this whole...
Did I say I was finished? No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
Behind this whole level of character interaction, what you were trying to do there... You have this really far-fetched thing where you're going out, and you basically explain it almost the way you did on The Extra. It's like, okay, you know, these pumpkins, you know, the one person goes and abuses them, and the pumpkins remember it, and they put the spores on them. Well, what were you really trying to get at here? Because obviously that's not the point. I don't think you were trying to make just a cheesy sci-fi film, because if you did, you figured it would be a little more tongue-in-cheek, and, you know, like your comedies are, where you're just, okay, this is really out there. Let's really spoof this. I do understand that you're actually going to be making the worst science fiction movie ever made. That's kind of where I think you would go with that, you know, like did with the worst horror movie. Whereas this was almost like you were trying to take it seriously, but there was nothing happening on that end because you barely saw the pumpkin monster, and for that matter, you barely saw the deaths other than the girl getting hit with the hammer. And yet, it just seemed like that was almost a big focus narratively, and I was like, that's kind of strange. What were you trying
to
say?
That's just your training from watching other movies. You're expecting that. Pretty much, Night of the Pumpkin was the anti-horror horror movie where I broke those rules. Like, I don't want to really give people an education in what screenplay or script structure is, but let's just say in the last 15 minutes of the movie, everybody has to spiral toward the resolution of the story, the plot. The lead character being a woman, and I said I wanted her to be a winner as a feminine spirit rather than a masculine spirit. She just stopped and puzzled everything out. She wrote things on paper and figured out a solution. And that was really funny to see in audiences. There's a big difference between the horror convention audiences and just people going to drink at the place I usually hold screening parties. But, you know, some people understood, some people didn't. And I'm okay with that. You know, I think I've declared that I'm not really good. You know, I try, but I don't really have a team with me.
Right.
You know, I'm only doing what I know of things, and sometimes I learn by failing at a movie. But, you know, if I had an actual budget for Night of the Pumpkin, there would be other people telling me, no, that's not going to work. We know because we have experience. You know, let's try it another way. So I admit that I don't have that sort of, I don't know if quality control is the word, but I don't have skilled people working with me. I just have myself, and I'm not skilled. I'm just creative. I also wanted to make fun of something that I had been seeing a lot in horror movies, and there's sort of like horror slash sci-fi movies. Like, I saw The Ruins.
Right.
Have you seen that movie?
I've heard about it, but no, I kind of stayed away from it.
So I don't want to say anything bad about the movie, but I hate when the movie is that stupid. You know, they have a premise that's really stupid. And even in the movie Inception, they say stupid things like we only use 10% of our brain. And that's just the most retarded saying ever. Actually, no one knows where the origin of that lies, but, you know, at different parts of the day and night, some areas activate and some areas are inhibited.
Right.
But your brain is constantly being used to its fullest. It's not like, you know, if you awakened your brain fully, you would be psychic and can fly and things like that, you know. The reason for that being declared in the movie was, have you seen Inception?
No, I am really bad with modern films.
Okay, well, and modern films are really bad. But
that's why. I avoid that plague.
But the reason that was said, and was said as if it were scientific fact, was to sort of explain why everything else is going to happen in Inception, because they said that, you know, when you're asleep, your brain works faster, so you can live 1,000 years in your dream or whatever, but it's only a couple of hours because your brain is that much faster. But the thing is, your brain, let's just say, is a big bundle of nerves. I don't want to say that because, you know, what's in your skull, they're not nerves, but a rose by any other name is still nervous. The rate of firing is limited to a certain range. Whether you're asleep or awake doesn't make your nerves any faster. But anyway, getting back to all this, because I don't want to talk about things that, because you don't know, a lot of other listeners have not seen these movies either.
Right.
But let's just say that I've watched a lot of science fiction and horror that were based on really stupid ideas. So the pumpkin creatures, they're my own invention. I was sort of inspired when I heard about this lake under ice, that there's sort of a debate, do we look in there? But if we look, we'll contaminate it. You know, this has not seen any of our modern organisms or whatever.
Right.
Or what if we awaken something in there? You know, and I wanted to make fun of the whole global warming thing. Not that I'm making fun of global warming, but I'm making fun of the ignorance of it.
You know,
what is it? So all that went to play. And, you know, like you said, it didn't work for you. It didn't work for a lot of people. Some people understood it. Some people needed me to explain it in the sort of cliff notes at the end of the movie. But, you know, I am the best director in the world.
So let's talk a bit about your use of often odd outsider fetishism. Not just your welcome focus on the female ass, which I have to thank you for, Bill, but stranger things, like the obsessive focus of points on rape films or on the mock crucifixion of semi-nude girls. What is this all about? Are you exploring personal fetishes, or are you reaching for some messed up segment of the viewing public here?
I have never tied up a girlfriend. I will never allow myself to be tied up because of an embarrassing thing that happened in a parking garage. But I might say that in a future interview. Boy, was that embarrassing. Okay. Apparently it was on security video.
Yeah.
Rape is even more of a taboo than it was when I started. And the reason why I have a rape theme or I make rape movies is because other people are afraid to. And I don't know if it actually gives me a competitive edge, but that's really the only reason for it. I don't like to rape girls. I don't like to be raped.
But wouldn't this sort of thing
I don't have rape fantasies or anything like that. Although I have to say that from watching, I guess they're called roughies, it's a lot more erotic for me to see, you know, like a bound. I know this sounds crazy, but it just seems that that's a little bit more kinky than watching just the straight porn, because I know both are fake, but one has, I guess, more entertainment value. I don't know. But as far as making it, it's just because it's a balls thing. I have balls. I have the balls to do it. If everyone were doing it, then I'd just move on to something else. You know, but,
yeah, because, I mean, I'm wondering, you're saying, like, you're presenting this like you're filling a demand in the market. You know, there was an empty space and you just jumped in and filled it. But yet, wouldn't you be speaking to a need that maybe shouldn't be out there in the first place? Like, you're almost encouraging these kind of people that might be messed up and check these things out. You know, I don't think
it's
a typical Beelzebub viewer, but, you know, I'm sure there's some freaks out there who get off on this. You know what I'm saying?
Well, in Ant Farm Dick Hole, I called attention to this study that was commissioned by one of our presidents about the effects of watching porn. And the hypothesis was that men who watch porn are less likely to render a guilty vote for a rapist. And
that wasn't even true.
Stuff like that.
Right.
Well, I haven't looked at the studies, but I have been told by professors that those were all bogus.
Right.
And I'm not saying that you're wrong to think that way, but a lot of times we all make assumptions about, you know, this guy likes that, so he's this way. And that's probably not supported by reality. I have read a lot about serial killers and about those types of people, and it seems that they have a fantasy life that then goes into the reality life. I don't know. But I think those people would be set off no matter what. I just don't care enough to really research those people. When I read about them, I'm reading about them more story-wise, not really trying to understand them. But I am not that kind of person. I'm just finding a niche or a Nietzsche. I'm a Nietzsche director. There's going to be a lot of revelations about that in the future movie Raped by a Rapist, which is sort of like My Ass Monster, but for the roughy crowd. Because okay. I have learned a lot that's just ridiculous. I don't really think that my rape movies are for the ultra perverts, because they hate my movies. And they hate them because it's more important for them to see a girl in distress than a girl to be naked.
Right.
And so in my movies like Breaking Her Will, when the girl is blindfolded and they couldn't see her eyes, you know, looking in fear, it really pissed them off. And I think I told you that I don't tie anybody up in real life. Like, that's just an illusion on the screen. So that pisses them off, too. So in Raped by a Rapist, you will find out a lot of things that are real about those kinds of people, and also a lot of things that are real about the kinds of movies that I do. And when you see the documentary King of the B-Movies, you're just not going to be able to reconcile the amount of laughter during the making of such a movie and what you see on screen.
Right.
You know?
It's all pretend, right.
But. Yeah. Also, so I don't know. What do you think? What do you really think? Do you think that I'm some kind of
rapist in the making?
I'm sorry?
No, I don't think that's what I said. I didn't know what to think. That's why I asked. I mean, I don't get that impression from you, which is why, you know, I'm not sitting there going, I don't know about this guy. He's a little off. You know, I'm sitting there like, it's Beelzebub. You know, so it's got to be a joke or something. But, you know, you got to wonder, like, what kind of audience you're feeding here. And also, the other thing I wanted to ask, which might not be so serious, but is just strange to me, is what is this fetish that you seem to have for, you know, having these naked girls on crosses? Because that's been, I don't know, hundreds of these things. You know, obviously, you don't put on hundreds of films, but you know what I'm saying. It's like all over the place. So where's that coming from?
Early on, I got wind of a site called, or I think they still exist, crucified-women.com, crucifiedwomen.com.
Okay.
And so I contacted the webmaster or the head honcho there, right, Oliver Hufkins, and I asked permission to use art for a cover of a movie. And he had started accepting videos from, I guess, photographers who use models and videos. I don't know. They're all European, those things. For a movie that is out of print called Crucifier, I actually did the crucifixion videos that you have seen in Dirt Bags. Those right. I filmed because they're bad, that they look stupid or whatever. I'm not a fetish guy, so I didn't understand why people like seeing girls tied. You know, they have to be really tied. So if you look at my crucified girls, they look like they can get out if they just move their arms.
Exactly.
But, yeah. Anyway, Oliver Hufkins then allowed me to use video footage for my horror movies. And so anytime you see a crucified girl in my movie, it's probably because it's been donated by him. You know,
but
I didn't.
What is that all about? I mean, it's just strange. It's not
you'd have to ask him.
Or at least to me. But
you'd have to ask him. I like the idea because I was thinking, you know, as I was growing older, men weren't the only ones who were crucified. And then when I learned about what crucifixion was, I was just wondering, you know, like there was a time when you could actually see people, you know, being so brutally put to death or, you know, humiliated. And for some reason, see, that's an important thing. At that time, the society said, that's okay. You know, this is fine. Hate those people and mistreat them. Like, not only are they dying, but they need to be humiliated more. So anyway, sort of as a curiosity, but nothing, you know, perverted. Like, I don't really want to go raping a girl on a cross or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's just strange. Like I said, why would you?
But because it's strange and it belongs in my island of misfit toys.
Hey, weird fetishes. Here you go.
Well, it's not a fetish because a fetish really needs to be an object. It has to be present in order for the guy to have an orgasm. It's not just something that's kinky. It's just a kinky thing, like some people are into it. But if you want to find out why people like that, crucifiedwomen.com, I think, goes into detail about what they like about it. But whenever I've videotaped it myself, I get yelled at. You know, I'm not satisfying them. Whatever they need, I don't provide.
Okay,
so I'm not really a fetish director.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Beelzebub. Coming up, we discuss Ant Form Dickhole, only here on Third Eye Cinema. topic of out there, let's speak to another of your horror-oriented films, Antoine Picoult. Once again, once again, you have Adam Kuligowski, and I'm not sure of her name. I think she might have been credited as Miss Liss in Antoine, but they were both also from Rap Sucks, where they were the guy who was trying to scam your limited edition Trouble record off you, and one of the D&D players who you kept from hooking up with some guy at a bar by slipping him an exploding cigarette. So here you have them as the bully who steals your car and a newscaster, respectively. How did you find these two? I had the impression when I first saw him that he was somebody from one of the bands you interviewed in your documentaries, but I couldn't find any references on him. And she seemed more like a goth punk type than you usually use, so she really stood out to me. You know, I've got to say that you always have decent-looking women in your films, and possibly even more so of late. But where did you find these two?
Well, Adam found me. He just saw me at a show and said he loved my movies and he'd like to be in one. And I asked, what are you doing Wednesday? Because I'm always writing, shooting, and editing. You know, so a lot of people, when they ask me, they're taken aback. They're thinking some far-off date.
Yeah.
Like, no, what are you doing Wednesday? So when I meet a person and I talk to the person, I can guess how that person will be on film. And I don't know if we talked about my love of early John Waters movies, where I actually didn't know why I liked the acting, but I liked it because it was non-acting, it was bad acting. I like playing around with that. But yeah, Adam is one of those people who just came up to me, as was Rocco Martone and
right.
many of the other people you see. You know, they're my friends now, but they weren't at first. They were just fans. So I also like that whole challenge of, you know, the mark of a director is he can direct anybody. Actually, don't believe that, because I have to be a real director in order to say what a director is. I'm a hack. So a real hack is someone who can direct non-actors. But Miss Liss is actually one of the owners of the Clash Bar in Clifton.
So
isn't that a reason for you to go drinking there now? Yeah, so if you go to the Clash Bar, there's a good chance that you'll run into her. Or if you see a screening party, there's a good chance that she's in the movie.
Again, mm-hmm. I'm not really sure what you were going for here. I don't get the whole weird conceit of the film, honestly. It's a bit more crass than Night of the Pumpkin, but it's just as bizarre, particularly with the lead running around through most of the film with a supposed Willy hanging out of his pants, spitting up killer bugs. There are also a lot of cheap puns where you're naming characters and emphasizing words that include the word aunt, like Anthony or Andrea. So why the move from your usual comedies to these sort of off-kilter horror films lately? Speaking only for myself, I much prefer the comedies. And, yeah, that does include Rap Sucks, despite all the shock value of the early D&D segments.
Are you trying to antagonize me? Unlike the Night of the Pumpkin movie, I don't actually want to tell anyone anything about Ant Farm Dickhole. I could tell you what inspired it, but I won't tell you much about the meaning of it, because some people really like the fact that the ants are so realistic. They really like that. They had a big special effects budget. Different people enjoy different aspects of it. Did you hate the movie?
No, I wouldn't say that. Yes.
Did you laugh?
I always get a laugh out of your films, whether it's intentional or not. And
you're not laughing with me, you're laughing at me.
Well, in certain cases, like this one.
We talked about this before, that, you know, I'm not really easily insulted, and I don't take myself that seriously, although I am pompous sometimes when I answer questions. It is pompous to call yourself pompous. But all right, and from Nicole, I can answer some questions, but I really want the enjoyment of the film to be you asking, what the hell is wrong with the guy who made this movie? You know? And may I ask you a question about Ant Farm Dickhole? Did you find anything mean-spirited about it?
It was a bit crass. It was certainly bizarre.
I gave everyone a day off with that movie. I didn't insult anyone, really. It was just a lot of fun. It was a movie that was done purely for pleasure. But if you'd like, I could tell you what inspired it.
Sure.
All right. I was at the worst horror convention ever, and I don't want to say the name of it. I'm not banned from it. That's not why I'm saying it. It's just,
okay.
There were more vendors than there were people, and the people who came were sort of flea market people. And it was an arrogant guy who ran the show. I'll get into the movie. So Mark Colgrove from Direwit Films, he made a movie called Isle of the Damned, which I call Gaylord Island because the only nudity is male. And I'm not talking about it as bad, because we joke with each other. So we were very bored, and he said that he always wanted to film an ant crawling into a penis. And I thought, there are two things wrong with that. Like, already you have this stigma with your Gaylord Island. Like, why do you want to show more male body parts or whatever? He's not gay, by the way. And he's not anti-gay, obviously, because he made Gaylord Island. But but then I was also thinking about distribution. You know, wouldn't that hurt distribution? So because I was so bored at this convention, I was just thinking of his scene and how I would never do something like that.
Right.
And I also know that I am unable to make a trailer. I suck at making trailers for my movie. I don't know if you agree, but I don't like giving away the plot. I was going to make a bunch of trailers for movies that didn't exist. And one of those trailer ideas was for Ant Farm Dickhole, where, you know, these images came to my head of a girl screaming, like, "He's got ants in his pants! Ah!" Ants in the pants are usually never screamed in terror. So that would be a comical thing for me, like a woman screaming, "He's got ants in his pants!" And every scene that followed something like that would be a black screen with a narrator saying, "Ant Farm Dickhole." At the end of the trailer, the narrator would say, "Rated Aardvark." That didn't make it into the movie. So I called my distributor, my main distributor, and I asked, "Look, if I make a movie called Ant Farm Dickhole, would that mean that it doesn't get into many stores because of the name?" And I just heard laughter because I was on speakerphone, and then I was ordered, "Bill, you have to make this movie." I said, "No, you don't understand. I don't want to lose money. Can this movie actually get into stores with that name?" And none of my questions were answered. I was just repeatedly told, "Make this movie." There might be a version later on this year called Human Ant Farm, because some of the big chains did say no because it was too extreme, but I'm not sure if it was the name or the antics. Horror conventions and film festivals that screen my movies for the public always tell me that they're never able to write a synopsis for any of my movies. So instead, they just talk about the qualities of the movie. So I guess maybe I'm not that untalented or unskilled. Maybe it's just that it's not easy to put all that into a synopsis.
Well, you're right, because thinking about that, if I try to summarize all the films that I've seen by you, it would be kind of tough. I mean, I might be able to give something very vague in general, but it wouldn't catch all the qualities that make the film interesting or amusing or bad or whatever it may be. You get this bare little details of, okay, this is what happens and then that happens and this guy does that. But to give it a proper synopsis, you're right. Your film's kind of, I don't know, there's just like a rambling quality to it. I think it's because of the absurdism that you're going for. Because how do you summarize something like Waiting for Godot? You say, okay, well, there's two bums on the street. That's it? You know, that's the whole thing? Why am I going to go see this? But yet, narratively, that's really all that happens. They just lay there and they're waiting for basically God to come and save them or something who doesn't exist or never comes or whatever the case may be, however you read it. And there's really nothing else to say about it. And you could say the same thing about Louis Buñuel films. Because it's like, well, yeah, okay, you know, The Street Charm of the Bourgeois. They're all sitting there eating dinner. And antics ensue. Well, do they really? And where does it really start and end? You know, is it kind of open-ended? It's vague. It's because that's not the point. The point is somewhere deeper. You know, there's a deeper level to all this. And it's really absurdism and existentialism and things that you touch on with your comedies, which is what makes them interesting, is that they have this extra level. So trying to describe them and put it in something like a synopsis or, you know, for that matter, a trailer is kind of difficult.
Well, I like absurdity. I've learned over the years that there are some people who can't deal with things that aren't right. I don't know if I mentioned that at horror conventions, there are people who just apparently subconsciously fix my table. You know, they'll tidy things up because, you know, as people handle DVDs and stacks of DVDs, things get sloppy. So there's some people who just get vexed if something isn't following an order that they expect. I'm not saying that people who hate my movies are those kind of people, but those kind of people can't watch my movies. I almost hit somebody at a horror convention because he was one of those message board tough guys. And he's also a message board idiot. I was asking something on a message board, and it had to do with an opinion about a movie. I was sending out movies, and I wanted to just know education level, age, and stuff like that. He said it doesn't matter. And I said, well, thank you for your great marketing experience, but I would really like to know. I wasn't actually looking at it from a marketing point of view. I just wanted to know if something that had a lot of references to stories and things like that. Like, if you read Dante's Inferno and any kind of classic, there's always footnotes because the classics reference other classics.
Right.
Well, they didn't know there were classics at the time. But, you know, there are references. And so I just wanted to know, like, does someone who doesn't really read these days like the movie as much as someone who's well-read and blah, blah, blah. So the real reasons why I wanted to know these values age, education, blah, blah, blah. It's for that.
Right.
And the guy kept saying that, you know, he went to college and that none of this is necessary. And he wouldn't just, he wouldn't stop chiming in. And so, but he met me at a convention, didn't reveal who he was. And so I stupidly gave him the worst horror movie ever made. That was actually the movie that I was giving out to people on the message board, various message boards. I just wanted to know. So a few weeks later, he revealed that that was him. I gave the movie to the one I hated on the message board. And he was just fucking dense. You know, he was saying things like, you know, the girl who blew Jesus, couldn't you use, like, something that looked more like cum, like hand soap? And I was like, why are you looking for something realistic? It's something called the worst horror movie ever made.
Of course.
So all of his complaints were like, please refer to the title of the film. Like, he didn't get it. He was that much of a jackass where he was expecting it to be, you know, sort of like on par with The Shining or something like
that. Right, right.
You know, he just didn't understand a thing.
Right.
So, you know, as stupid as he was before the movie, I consider him more stupid. And I really did, I have to be honest with you, feel that if I saw him again, I would just punch him in the face. Not saying they just punch him in the face. But, you know, the rational side of me knows that, you know, he's just condemned to be that dense his entire life. Not even brain surgery can help him. There are no drugs that can help him. He is just doomed to be that jackass for the rest of his life. And, you know, when a person wants to hit another person from that kind of anger, it's sort of like the punishment factor in us. Like, we want to punish. But no amount of punishment, no behavior modification will change him. He is a jackass. Fuck that guy! Sorry, I'm in the parking lot and I just see people turn around. All right, sorry. No more tirades.
Hey, listen, Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Dolzy Bob. Coming up, we discuss his two Jesus movies and upcoming releases, and we'll have a finale. Let me hear on Third Eye Cinema. Sense of subtlety, as in your ever so telegraphically titled film where you express your feelings about Jesus. Tell us how you really feel, Bill.
Did you like Jesus as a total douchebag?
It was the same thing as with Rap Sucks. Once you got past the intro, which was really crap, you know, it was like you pushed all the offensive buttons to the highest and you delivered something that was just mouth-dropping in so many respects. And then once you got past that and you got to the later scenes, which I'll mention in a minute, it started to work again. I'm like, okay, there it is. There's the Bilzy Bub films I'm used to.
That movie in particular, that was made for fun and with the expectation that no store will carry it. So that's why I went as far as I could with all the jokes. Really far. Too far.
You had a particularly bizarre, inept-sounding song running through the opening credits. I noticed you have a few of these sort of joke tracks sprinkled throughout your films. Where do you find this stuff? Is it sent in by fans or something? It's really just awful in so many respects. And I was like, where are you getting this? It sounded homemade. It didn't sound like a band would put something like that out, unless it was a total joke.
What the hell was the intro that you're talking about?
It was the whole crazy thing with...
No, I know visually dolls. It's the crucified Barbie dolls, but I'm...
But you've used those images a lot in your films, or the title menu.
Wait a minute. If you're thinking about the song, that's my Merciful Fate rap, where I just sing stupid lyrics over Merciful Fate songs. That was just meant as a joke.
Right, that's what I'm saying. It was like a
and
joke
if that song. If that is the beginning song that you're talking about, that wasn't really meant for anybody. That was meant for me to aggravate people during an earlier radio show. I might have even been at WMSC.
You're right, and I've heard these kind of things on your radio shows as well. That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm talking about. Where are you getting this?
Okay, yeah, that's just me being stupid. for a very stupid beginning.
There's some real flagrant abuse of Barbie dolls here as well. You've included the crucified Barbie image on some versions of your DVD releases, dating way back to some early versions of Worst Horror Movie, maybe even the original Metalheads. I know it's been floating around for years. So did you film that intro segment long before the rest of the film was completed and released?
The intro, the Barbie dolls that are crucified, were actually for an out-of-print movie, Dalla Morte.
Okay.
You know, I just didn't want to let that bizarre footage go to waste, you know, and I was thinking, who cares about the opening credits to a movie anyway?
You know, I have to say, and again, we're talking about more of the beginning especially, but this really was one of your more juvenile films, particularly the whole virgin birth sequence. It actually felt, like I mentioned to you off-air last time, it felt like a Catholic school teenager's attempt at being blasphemous. It's that far over the top. And once again, we see that drug dealer character from, I think it was the Dirtbags remake, the one with the ping pong ball eyes as the other Jesus. You really covered your bases trying to offend everyone possible here now.
Yeah, I'm not going to pretend that the movie is more sublime than it is. It does have parts in it that I think are the highbrow parts, but generally this is just a free-for-all, you know, with limitations, because you know that if I were a total asshole, my movies wouldn't get out there. You
and
know,
they
would
be
stopped.
I wouldn't even be watching them. Yeah, once again, as we wrap Sucks, after a really wildly offensive first half, things turn more typical Josie Bob about 40 minutes in. We're having these long discussions with Peter and the Roman Centurion, and then the one with, you actually list her as Clairvoyant, who plays a nude female Judas. Those are pretty amusing, and she made a good gadfly foil to you throughout the remainder of the film. Again, very attractive girl, and seemed a bit more towards the goth punk end of the equation than metal, so I wasn't sure where you picked her up. But again, it really did work. All the scenes with her and you were really the highlight of the film.
Now, the funny thing is, she's a model. She, I believe, has natural acting ability. You know, of course, could be refined with training, but she's a model.
Right.
She also makes clothes. She's actually the dark-haired girl who's on the cover of I Told You Not to Call the Police. She's in that movie. And she's also in Rap Sock. The girl says, I actually don't know her dialogue, so I don't care about that. Nope. But yeah, she has blonde hair now instead of black hair,
right,
for that. And yes, she will be in more movies. She's one of the surprises. There are a lot of girls who surprise me who are so beautiful and so amazing physically.
Yeah.
And they're better at comedy than they are at the damsel in distress, in my opinion.
Right.
I think you agree with me that she was really good. Her comic timing was,
very much so.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
like
so
said,
she's Lydia Lail from the from the Ruffies, I call them. But in the Jesus movie, she's Clairvoyant.
And it feels horribly blasphemous. So anyone religious should probably hear Clair, but that should be kind of obvious given the title of the film.
Yeah, if you write me an email about how annoyed you were, how offended you were at Jesus the Total Douchebag, you should really just kill yourself. Why would you buy something called Jesus the Total Douchebag? Oh, I'm so surprised that this was insulting to me.
You also included the remake of Metalheads on this disc. Is this another alternate edit, or is it the same version you released?
No, same version. I think for Extreme Metal Retardation, there'll be a re-edit. Not a remake, a re-edit of Metalheads. Just because there were a couple of things that I did wrong in the first edit. Well, way more than a couple of things, but the ones that I'm going to correct.
And you also made a more serious sort of horror companion piece to this film, Zombie Christ. This covered a lot of the same territory, but without so much of the humor. In place of trying to inject a little sarcasm and absurdism into the Gospels, you deliver a very didactic treatise about how Christianity essentially derives from the Romans, and that the Romans pretty much stole everything from the Greeks, and that went back to Egypt. There was barely any plot, once again, in terms of action and character development. It was another one of those mumblecore films like Night of the Pumpkin. But, you know, again, I think your strengths lie more in your comedies and in your documentaries than in these more serious, experimental sort of horror entries. For me, anyway, they just don't work as well. I was terrified by the skeleton with the crown of thorns, though.
Yeah, that was a learning experience, the whole silicone-covered medical skeleton, which was heavy as hell. There were a lot of things that I couldn't pull off. I didn't have the time. I don't really want to say that it was because I was limited by budget, but that had a lot to do with things. I think the sort of surfing Zombie Christ on the river was better that it was shot, you know, so cheesily. Is that actually an adverb now? Cheesily? But there are little nods to other movies. Like, have you seen Hellraiser 2?
Yes.
So you understand that this guy who was ripped apart sort of became intact in Hellraiser 2. He reformed,
right,
not personality-wise, but physically, when other people bled onto him. Sort of the same premise, this zombie Christ was going to rebuild himself by pulling the partially digested wafers out of the bowels of other people. So that was holy shit. There were a lot of things in Zombie Christ. I don't want to defend it to you, because if you didn't like it or if you felt that the movie had no plot, then I failed in your eyes.
Right.
I don't really want to do the Cliff Notes thing that I did for Night of the Pumpkin at the end of the movie. So if you didn't derive anything from it, then I failed. And
it seemed to be treading the same ground as the Jesus movie, except that it didn't have the humor. It was just, okay, this is more serious, and it's just kind of going on and on. And I'm like, okay, well, yeah, those are historical facts. Okay, that's an interesting thought. But, you know, nothing was really...
When I wrote it, I wrote it to be a serious movie, but then as I was developing the ideas of how to shoot it, I was thinking, all right, the low-budget one has to have comedy, and it has to be really over-the-top comedy. Yeah, the super serious version doesn't have those comedic qualities.
Right.
Although, who knows what will make a person laugh, because a lot of people credit me with being so... People say genius, I'm sure they're not referring to someone whose IQ is over a certain number. But, you know, they think that I'm a visionary in some comedy, and it wasn't meant to be funny. Anyway, if you didn't get much out of Zombie Christ, then I can't really say anything more.
Well, again, it might just be my orientation, because I really appreciate your comedies. I think there's this multi-leveled humor there, where you're going for the lowbrow, sort of slapstick, cheesy, whatever, absurdist laughs, and then you get the higher level of absurdism, where you're injecting some philosophy into this, and there's like a deeper point being made about existentialism and how absurd life is, basically, you know, no matter what we're doing. And that makes those really stand out and work for me. And the documentaries also, you know, you kind of edit them in a certain way without narrating or anything else, where you're making certain points and you're showing how people contradict each other. And, you know, they're actually fairly well structured for what they are. If there's something that's basically more of an interview disc than a quote documentary, they work well. Whereas these other ones, these horror films, I don't know, it's just, you see the didactic side, but it just doesn't seem to work. I'm not getting whatever you're trying to put out there. It's not getting to me.
I'm not personally a horror person. I love certain movies that are horror movies, but I don't really understand what makes horror fans horror fans. For some reason, I have developed followings in the conventions that I've returned to. You know, there's always someone who becomes the convert, the Beelzebub convert. I would not be able to write an essay, you know, what is a horror movie? So when I attempt horror, it's from my own, I guess, ignorant way. You know, I don't know what you need as a horror fan
right.
to make you love the horror movie, or to make you love one of my horror movies. I think that the people who like my horror movies like it for other aspects. You know, and, you know, as I mentioned, if I ever get budgets, or if I ever raise budgets for like the serious Zombie Christ or the serious Night of the Pumpkin, they will probably flop in the horror crowd. I don't know. Or maybe 20 years from now, people will be ready. I don't even know what entertainment will be like 20 years from now. It's sort of sad that the DVDs and Blu-ray seem to be dwindling in shelf space. You know, if you look at stores, there are certain fans who love subjecting other people to my movies. So that's, I guess, the fun they get out of owning a Beelzebub movie, that they get to terrorize other people with it. With the worst horror movie ever made, I have actually told people, watch it yourself first, and then watch it with a group of people, and make sure that one of the people is an uptight person. I don't know if we talked about Jesus the Total Douchebag, but there was someone from South Carolina who had an advanced copy, and I had to ask, you know, South Carolina, I don't know anything other than, you know, the stereotypical image of it. I have never been to South Carolina, but I've been to conventions that had people from South Carolina in them, and the South Carolinians seem to be suffering. You know, the ones whom I've met, they don't really like being in South Carolina because of narrow-mindedness. So I don't know if that's actually true of the place. You know, I've visited many areas that I thought that I was like Jesus going to Jerusalem. I am going to die if I go into that city or into that region. But anyway, this viewer from South Carolina told me that, yeah, there are a couple of moments where I went a little far, but he said that during the viewing of the movie, a neighbor walked in and was disgusted, absolutely disgusted at first, but for some reason did not leave.
Right.
And within a half an hour started laughing, and whenever that person laughed, my fan yelled, "Sinner!" And what made me happy about all this was not that someone very religious walked in on the movie, because I really don't want those people to see my movie. I like pushing buttons and all that, but I don't really want people who shouldn't be watching it to watch it. Yes, I get a kick out of uptight people being subjected to the movies, or my fans subjecting other people to it, but that's not my intention when I make the movie. But anyway, getting back to the guy from South Carolina, the reason why I'm so happy about that story was that I got someone who actually had no investment in my movies to laugh at something that you would expect a guy from South Carolina to not find funny. Too bad that there wasn't a hidden camera, you know, where I could actually watch what made that guy crack, you know.
Right.
From hating me to actually laughing. That's the way I'd like to invade a country. I'll make you laugh. That's the way I'd like to take you over. Not by disgusting you, but by entertaining you. May I ask you something?
Sure.
When you watched Jesus a Total Douchebag,
right,
and you found yourself laughing out loud,
yes,
did you feel bad for laughing at the things you found funny?
Not really. You know, I'm pretty much of an iconoclast myself, but, you know, I did grow up as a Catholic, and, you know, some of these things are like, I don't want to say hot buttons anymore, but you still got that in you, and I never thought, like, oh, I'm going to go to hell for laughing at this or anything like that. It was just...
Did you ever expect to see something go that far?
No, not at all.
And religious humor. I killed two birds with one stone.
And that's what I'm saying. You just set out to offend everybody, and damn it, you did it.
I would be offended. I would be angry if a genuinely nice person were made to watch a movie like that. You know, we were joking around about the title of the movie, but the title should be a warning. Don't watch this if you're a certain way.
Exactly.
And, you know, the movie's not widely dispersed either. Well, I don't know if I could say that after, you know, the torrent sites get hold of it. But I would really like for people not to dangle that in front of the really nice people out there. They don't need to see that. You know, the movies are really for people who like the ultra spicy. You know, there are people who like a little bit of black pepper on their food, and then there are people who want their mouths on fire.
But,
so hopefully I can satisfy you if you're the latter type, but don't make nice people watch my movie. You know, the judgmental asshole religious person, yeah, go ahead, show that person my movie, but not the really nice people. They're necessary for our population to thrive. And I don't mean to grow. I mean to actually, you know, be worth something. You know,
right,
if you like this country, or even people in other countries, don't subject the really nice people to the movies. That would make me mad. Like, I really wouldn't want your parents or your mom to see the movie. I would not like that.
Let me reiterate, particularly after some of the stuff we've been discussing in the latter half of the show, that I am a Beelzebub fan. You know, you're a true iconoclast in a world populated by far too many followers and far too few free thinkers and originals. You can always tell a Beelzebub product because your personality and stamp is all over it, and that's a good thing. You know, I've been listening to your radio show since the late 80s. I was a faithful reader of the Grimoire when it was available for free up at Tower Records, and I've been enjoying your films and documentaries at least since the original Metalheads was released, which I think that was your first film.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got a great sense of humor and a good understanding and use of the absurd. And your films are filled with plenty of attractive naked girls, which is always appreciated. Yet, you've also exposed me through radio, film, and documentary some interesting music that in many cases I probably wouldn't have been exposed to otherwise. For example, Primordial. It's just not the sort of thing they play on the radio, even with, quote, specialty shows. But, of course, I'm something of an iconoclast myself, and I hold few things as particularly sacred, so my thoughts might not be applicable to the general populace. So I just want the audience to understand that while I have reservations about certain aspects of some of your more recent films like we discussed, they are very much worth seeking out if you've got a good sense of humor and you aren't easily offended. And Bill didn't pay me to say this. Speaking for myself, I definitely appreciate seeing more of your comedies in the future. And I understand you're working on the worst science fiction film ever made, because I'm looking for...
the cheesiest science fiction movie ever made.
I'm looking forward to that one for sure. And also on the documentary end, I believe Metal Retardation 2 is in the works. So is there anything else that you want to address or plug?
Well, the extreme metal retardation, I was going to call it Metal Retardation 2, but I didn't want people to avoid obtaining it because they didn't see Metal Retardation 1. That is not a documentary. It's just pure shenanigans.
Right.
You know, the thing that's different is that I have a lot of girls coming up with their own questions instead of them just, you know, sitting on laps or reciting my questions. There's a girl who has not interviewed yet. Her name is Melissa. She's going to interview Teresa's. Originally, I didn't want that to happen because I've already interviewed them and I've already
right.
found them to have a great sense of humor. You wouldn't think that the singer would tolerate being asked about spider sharks and things like that. But so in the beginning of April, she is going to have total retirement with him. So the movies, well, I don't want to call it documentary. The music DVD will just be constant shenanigans. Voivod will be part of it. I don't really want to go too far into that. It's just, if you want to see a serious thing, then that's not it. That's not the movie for you. And it will have a re-edit of Metalheads. Part of the reason for that is just to show you things you haven't seen before if you've seen the first Metalhead. And then an edit that should have been the first edit. You know, there's certain important scenes in there that had to be presented in a certain way, but because I didn't have the skill at the time, I gave you what you saw. And now you'll see something great. I'm also going to re-film Metalheads a third time. No, just kidding. I have in the works a very serious project. I've been working at this for a long time. It's my Frankenstein movie. Peter Steele was supposed to play Victor Frankenstein as well as the monster. Of course, that can't happen now. But that's how far back it goes. You know, I've always wanted to make Frankenstein. And so I am going to attempt it. The only way I could make it is an art house movie where it's not meant to be a blockbuster. Well, can I really do something like that anyway?
No.
But I have been working and working and working on this, and I figure I'm probably going to die soon, maybe even this year. So I would like to make my Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. It's not a period piece. There's no menstruation in it. No, it's not a period piece because Mary Shelley, when she wrote Frankenstein, didn't write it to be a period story. She meant it to be contemporary. So
right.
That's what I'm going to do. But I'm still going to preserve the rich dialogue. And my way of handling that is I'm having foreigners as all the main characters because the people who speak the best English are people who are learning how to speak English, the Oxford English.
Right.
So I really want Ida Barkland from
I was just gonna name
up.
Her. I was
yep.
just gonna
I want
name
her to play. She has to play Elizabeth, and if I have to fly to Sweden to film her parts, then that's what I'll do. I've also waited to get better equipment because I want that to be at least HD, but it looks like it's going to be 4K resolution, which is, you know, the theater resolution. But apparently in a few years, we're going to have 4K TVs.
Well,
imagine four times the resolution of HD. You can see every pimple.
Yep.
From across the street.
HD's already
porn is going to be destroyed. You're never going to want to watch porn with that kind of resolution.
It's true. It's already very unflattering to a lot of people.
Except
and what's
me.
Weird is when you watch the film from like the 40s or something, you've always seen it the same way. And now, even though the thing is, you know, 60, 70 years old, like, oh my God, look at this person's pimples. Look at their eczema. These things are really popping out. So I can't even picture what four times that would be.
Yeah, there's going to be a different interpretation of popping out of a dress. I'm also making a movie called Fanzine Editor, which is a somewhat fictionalized account of the grimoire history. And the thing that inspired that was just the ridiculous history of the grimoire itself.
Right.
In our first of 14 interviews, I talked about how every success was an accident and how I could never do it again. So that's what led to it. I don't know if it's going to be a comedy. I don't know if it's going to be a film festival movie because I do want to address the offensiveness because in the grimoire, I started asking racial questions like with the Van Malevolent Creation. And racial anything is a big film festival no-no. That's one of the reasons why Worst Horror Movie Ever Made did not play a big festival in Canada. I don't want to name it because if I do, it'll sound like I'm disrespecting. I'm not disrespecting that festival. And they also didn't like the 9/11 joke. I'm the first one who had 9/11 humor in a movie. It even predates the Worst Horror Movie Ever Made with a terrible movie called Metal Radio. Terrible movie. I actually unearthed the footage because I'm ashamed of it. I never wanted to see it. It was locked away. But I do have a clip which I'm contributing to the documentary King of the B-Movies where Metal Dave wears a shirt that I actually painted. I was going to have this done, like at least 100 of them at a horror convention, but I was talked out of it. It's the World Trade Center building. There are airplanes sticking out of them with people falling out going splat. And it just reads, planes hit the World Trade Center and all I got was this lousy t-shirt.
Ooh, ouch.
And it was more to make fun of the whole consumerism of that event, you know, whether it's a documentary. It's just a disguised way to make money, make lots of money with 9/11.
Wow.
Actually, I made fun of it a little bit in my Dalla Morte movie where someone wanted to call the police and said, I'm going to call 9/11, but get it, 911.
Yeah, I got it.
But I don't really want to plug a future thing is because I will probably die. And I don't mean assassinated. Like, I am dying. And or I just might have a different project that will prevent one. I plan to do that this year, and I plan to do the cheesiest science fiction movie this year. And, you know, as far as the pervert movie goes, I have something called Love Me or I Will Kill You.
Okay.
But that's much more story-oriented than any previous sex horror. It's sort of like Breaking Her Will. My giant forehead. You can see it from space. That's how big my forehead is. So... I am sexy. I don't know if you asked that question, but the answer to that is yes. I don't just play someone super sexy in the movies. I am. You were probably afraid to, you were afraid to ask that question, so I asked it for you.
With that, Bill, I'd like to thank you for joining us here on Paradise Cinema. And
thank you.
We'd love to have you back to discuss any new projects, music, or just talk philosophy a bit.
What are you doing Wednesday? I guess that's it, unless you want any personal information that I don't know is being taped. Oh, yeah. Yeah, my penis is really small. It's actually been written up in medical journals, and it makes these burping noises when I urinate. Thank God you're not taping. You know, I almost slipped during the interview and said that. But, yeah, thank you for everything, and I'm sorry that you have to go through all the torture of editing this.
Thanks for joining us tonight. We hope you enjoyed part two of our up-close and personal interview with Bill Debub. Next week on Paradise Cinema, our special April Fool's Day presentation of Slasherama, where we discuss the 80s slasher film with fellow aficionado Tim Ritter, director of Killing Spree and the Truth or Dare films. If you'd like to contact us here, comment, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker or musician who'd like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com or visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema brought to you by the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Cinema broadcast, just visit our Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive listener download at your convenience.